What do you think the strumpets usually do?
I mean, I've heard all sorts of stories. It's mayhem. It's like equal parts literary analysis and like plotting to overthrow the government. And wine? It's an all-night dance party. You also read short stories. It's Sodom and fucking Gomorrah and fiction. Started with a tweet from Lauren Groff talking about how her students were like, hey, why are all short stories depressing? And that was the hullabaloo for an afternoon and evening. And I was thinking about that.
Very strange.
Is it because it's harder to build a happy arc that feels satisfying in the length of a short story?
I mean, absolutely. I think absolutely. And I think also it's just also a question of space. I mean, Austin, any Austin novel, shave off the last 20 pages and it's fucking bleak. It's a claustrophobic look at like women trapped in a marriage plot that doesn't end well. And I think with short stories, you don't have that extra 20 pages. Like you don't have, you know, Mr. Darcy saying, I must tell you how ardently I admire and love you. You just have like a woman realizing she's made a terrible mistake. And then it's 25 pages and sort of the story comes to its natural conclusion.
I feel like you have more leeway to be unresolved in a short story, which means you don't have to bring it around to the happy ending. If you're going to leave something unresolved, you can end it on an disquieting note. And I always say with short stories that the ones that stay in my head are the ones that leave me feeling unsettled at the end.
One of the very first short stories that I ever read was The Lottery, and it just stayed with me forever. I never thought that a short story could impact me so much. I just kept thinking about it, you know, and it was also this open ending.
Which I also love.
Yeah, I forgot to ask Rebecca because we need to introduce you.
I mean, thank you so much for having me on the show. First of all, like it's really a pleasure to be here. Rebecca Rukeyser. I'm a writer. I write short stories. I finished a novel called The Seaplane on Final Approach that's coming out. It's going to be published next summer from Granta Books in the UK. And Doubleday in the U.S. And I am a huge fan of the grimm. Like, probably where my deep love abides. Yeah, realizations of loss rather than, like, epiphanies that bring everything together. Give me unresolved. And I will scream with glee. Yeah, I love that. There's definitely a perverse element of it where you read it and you feel sort of your life is a little more luminous.
Give her unresolved.
A little dark, a little unresolved. I'm thriving during the pandemic. I am not.
Are you reading dark stuff now, though? Because I'm not at the moment. I'm revisiting some childhood favorites and getting like a warm fuzzy feeling from it. And I don't think I want to read dark stuff right now.
I mean, what I've done is I've like sharpened the blade of darkness. If I were to say my favorite genre of writer is a mid-century British female novelist, like give me a Barbara Pym where things are like slightly terrible and everyone's eating a sad lunch alone out of a can. Like that's where my joy lies. But during the pandemic, that's a little too close for comfort. And so I've been reading stuff like, I mean, the thing that I was talking to Sharon about for ages is Into Thin Air by John Krakauer. Like I want things to be slightly worse. You can't just be eating out at like having a sad lunch alone. You have to be dying on Everest. Sharon, or what have you cracked that yet?
I did crack it, Rebecca, and I'm with you there. I am gonna reread.
Do you want to climb Everest with me?
I do.
The only thing better than climbing Everest is robbing a bank and then climbing Everest.
Now that's a book I would read.
But in the meantime, why don't we switch to talk about this story then?
All right. We bantered on, didn't we? And we were supposed to get down to
business. To the nitty gritty here. What's the story today, Erin?
Story today is Entrapped by Martha Ketty, and it is dark. It's definitely grim.
I know you're in there. I wonder if you can hear my voice or feel my presence, my touch. You might not even look like a human being yet. I once saw pictures in a biology book, and I know that a human fetus looks pretty much the same as a piglet for a long time. But those look cute when they come out. Nothing like a baby, with its big head, all blue and squishy, covered in yellowish paste. I've seen it before, a long time ago, and the images have never left me. You will most likely be even more ugly. Being evil leaves its marks. We've tried to get rid of you, more than once. But you cling to the pink wall like ivy. You're a fighter, that's for sure. And for that, I must respect you. Our last chance to do something against your existence has passed for the moment. There is nothing else to do but wait. Wait for you to grow and come out. Wait to put an end to it all. I still have hope. You might die during this ordeal, but I must admit it's unlikely. Sometimes I pretend you don't exist. Her body not yet showing any signs makes it easy. But when the nauseating smell of vomit floats through the room, it always comes back to me. Now the vomiting has stopped. There's the visibly growing bulge under your mother's loose jumper that reminds me every time I wake up. If looks could really kill, you would have suffered 100 miserable deaths already. But lucky me, I'm no superhero, or villain for that matter. If I was, we wouldn't be in this situation in the first place. We would have never rotted away in this damp darkness. It could have been possible to escape. Some say being a superhero is a choice, but I see it differently. Either you have it or you don't. Nothing about this was my choice. Every night, I wish you die. But you never do. Ergo, no superpowers whatsoever. In the beginning, I found it unnerving that there was no way of knowing if you were still alive. That has changed now. The womb seems to grow every day, while the rest of the body holding you shrinks into its bony framework. The belly is all that is round now. And you, probably. You have been taking all the fat and energy out of your mother, the life-sucking leech you are. No wonder there are legends about vampire children. You're one of them. Not that there will ever be a story about you, about any of us. We're not destined for anything but death. The sooner the better. Do you listen? Can you hear my rambling by now? I've lost count of the days and month you've been in there, but the belly is so big you must almost be ready to come out. Which means you can hear me now. And listen. I can feel your movements underneath my palm. Just this thin layer of warm, bruised flesh between us. I press harder and you press back, with head or back, foot or hand. It remains hard to tell. You've been moving more and more, and the movements have become visible from the outside. The walls around you are closing in, and you've begun to feel restless. Claustrophobia is common in our family. At least your cell is a cheery pink. Nothing like the gray brick walls we must endure. I imagined you with jet black hair, a crown of darkness befitting all you've brought on us. You know how I feel about you. I notice the change of your pushes when my hands come closer. When you hear me speak, you probably pick up on the disgust in my voice, the suppressed hatred. It's not so surprising, I guess. I've despised your existence ever since we realized you had settled yourself into the thickened wall of the uterus. This was not supposed to happen. Do you not see we had a plan? We had it all figured out until you came along and changed your mother's mind, dragging me down with her into an abyss of hopeless resignation. I could never leave her. Born and die together, that's still the plan. I sit comfortably on the mattress. I can keep the position for hours without moving much. It seems to come naturally to me, but I had so much time to practice. You, on the other hand, are never still, performing a silent dance of which only you know the choreography. I can't help but watch your every move, by now visible through skin and fabric, even in bad light. I've begun to imagine you as a swimmer, with a tiny turquoise swimsuit and a ridiculous little hat. And sometimes you even wear diving goggles. How much joy you must feel to float weightlessly in your bubble. Will being born feel like a punishment to you as the weight of your own body renders you almost immobile for months? I hope so. It would mean that you're punished by your birth, just as we already are. She used to be beautiful, your mother. I wish you could see the marks you've left already on her body. The reddish stretch marks that are visible on the pale skin of the engorged belly. The angry scratches from her fingernails, unable to resist the urge, a reaction to the itches you're causing. They're everywhere, on the arms and legs as well as the belly. When you change your position, the cocoon changes its outer form. I've become well acquainted with the different positions you take. Bottom up, feet down, left side, right side. It's a matter of days in which you will still be able to turn. You need to float head down, do you hear me? This is important. I push you, slightly, to make you listen. You press back, defiant. For a few weeks now, I've been preparing for your birth. All that I could remember and can do under these circumstances, anyway. Your mother can't take it much longer. Are you listening? You've sucked the life out of her. She looks like she's going to burst into tiny little shreds of herself any moment. So everything is ready for you. You just need to give the go. How much longer do you want to stay inside her? I poke you. Out of anger and also to make sure you're still alive. There was some blood this morning and I find myself worrying about your safety. Not that you've earned it. At least you turned yourself head down in time. If not, I might have kicked you. I was thinking about it a lot. How to make you disappear. You were a burden right from the start, and once you're born, you will be an even bigger one. A big, smelly bundle of lost hopes. The waves are coming regularly now. From time to time, I feel your movements within this heaving body that looks so much like my own. And doesn't. An alien has taken over, using it as a cocoon to become, well, an usurping, miserable worm. This is so wrong in so many ways. It is time you come out. It is time we end this. But I can feel your reluctance. You still kick and move as much as you can in what is left of this narrow space. The waves press you down. If you want to or not, does not matter anymore. I will need your help soon. You need to want to come out. I give you an emphatic push with my flat hand from the side. The body gives way. But I feel your round back once I hold it in place with my other hand. There is not much time once you're stuck with your head in the pelvis. I check on you again, for you have become calmer with every push. But push we must. Your mother is so incredibly tired, all her reserves gone. You've used them all up over the past months. a leech out for blood. I can see the top of your head now. Your hair is so light that it's almost visible underneath the blood and vernix. I hope your head is not too big. I know a tear is a common complication. Here, under these circumstances, it is a sentence of more suffering. So I hold back your damned head, mimicking what I saw all these years ago. Remembering suddenly our mother's hands. Just for a second. I let you come slowly, even though all I want is to say push. You need to come out now. You would not survive long should you get stuck. I would like to push with you, together with the next contraction. Give my best help, pressing hard against your butt or feet, something on the upper end. But that could do more damage. And then your head is outside. No help needed. Ugly, bluish, wrinkled. One more, and there comes your squished, tiny body. I help you along as good as I can. Just like me, though, you have some soft meat on your delicate bones. The filthy mattress is immediately soaked with the fluids that follow your entrance into this world. I hold you up, look at you, and turn you around. You look flawless at first glance. No unnecessary toes. Not that I can see much anyway in the dimness of this place. I rub your breast slightly to animate your breathing. Why can't I let you die in peace? Please make no noises. Please don't. Sound carries down here. I would like to keep them from knowing you're already here. You're trying to open your eyes. Better leave them closed. There is nothing for you to see anyway. I put you down on the bare breasts. It's the warmest place, I promise. I wait for the cord to pump all the needed blood into your still bluish body. Once whitish, the pulse no longer palpable. I feel for the right distance to your belly. You won't feel a thing. I bind the cord above the navel and cut it off with my knife. I feel relief. You no longer belong to the body of your mother. Nope. Keep your hands away. You should leave it alone. Sleep now, baby, while I do the rest. But how can you sleep? Are there still contractions coming? Here comes the placenta, gooey and warm. Can you smell the blood? Will you miss it? Its warm, dark presence next to you in what you knew was safe. As home. How often did you touch its surface, soft, with its rough bits of dead cells like pebbles in soft sand, left behind by time? No worries, I won't throw it out. We've not had something so nutritious in ages. But before we eat, I must check if it's complete. You see, if there's a piece missing, your mother might bleed out. You suckle so intently on the breast as if your life depends on it. Maybe it does. You seem to shrink back when I put a blanket over your naked body. So this is how you thank me. I always knew you were ungrateful. Without me, you wouldn't be here. I realize this is truer than intended. Without me, you would not exist. It is my fault you're down here. It is my mistake that God is here. But it does not help to dwell on that. You, on the other hand, are the perfect object to muse about. I wonder if I should detach you from the breast. Will it not make the inevitable separation harder for the two of you if I wait? You seem to enjoy the warmth. You keep your eyes closed. Maybe that's a good thing. This way you look like a faceless, wrinkled, meaty worm. Ugly. Like I was certain you would. It is always easier to hate an ugly thing, even when it's innocent. And you're growing on me, making me queasy. I don't want to like you. You will be taken away anyway. In a few hours, if you're lucky, in a few minutes, if you aren't. Everything has stopped for a moment. An unexpected pause. The gray walls around us seem to come closer, the cold floor pressing its uneven surface into my body. I lie down next to you, so exhausted that it becomes impossible to keep my eyes from falling shut. I can still hear, though. I hear you and your mother breathe. A hand on her arm, I keep track of her heartbeat. Yours I try not to care about. The pregnancy and birth have taken so much from her already. You've taken all you could get your meaty, slimy fingers on. And I'm waiting, listening for footsteps on the other side of the wall, for the doors to open and end this moment of rest, of peace. For peaceful it is, just for an inexplicably miraculous moment. I must have fallen asleep. I'm startled by the metallic sound of bolts being opened. I'm afraid to even look. Can't bear to see them take you from her, or to see her face, a mirror of my own, twist in an unknown agony. She just doesn't know that it's better this way. She can't see how much you have ruined. Without you, our 4 years perfectly planned escape could have worked. So I keep still and hold her free arm. I wanted you to die, crumble and wither like we do under this freezing darkness around us. And now I want you to suffer for taking the tiny shred of hope we had left. But what do I know of where you're going? Nothing. Just that you will not come back. I feel her struggle, holding on to your tiny body with all the strength she has left, trying to free the arm I'm holding. But I don't let go. And then they must have gotten you out of her fragile arm, for she goes suddenly limp. I lie next to your mother in the darkness. I can feel her breathe. In and out, slowly. There's so much I want to say, but my lips feel too numb to move. I haven't heard you scream. Not during your mother's struggle to keep you, not after when they took you away. Maybe you were already dead when they came. I have no idea how we survived for as long as we have. A newborn like you never had a chance in the first place, not in here. But then you've proven me wrong before. I wonder if you will ever come looking for us, if you will ever know where you came from. But then, how could you? How would anyone? We will not leave anything behind. Anything but you. I open my eyes.
What was your first impression?
I mean, my first impression was one of claustrophobia, right? This is really like touching on so many different facets of how people can be claustrophobic, how claustrophobia can impact a life or lives. And I mean, naturally, at this juncture in history, I think that reading about claustrophobia in a lockdown, which is already serving up just all the claustrophobia we can choke down. I think that was an interesting confrontation. One of the questions that came to me is like, how would I have felt reading this in December of 2019, right? How will I feel reading this 2 years from now when claustrophobia is not such a part of my life and, you know, I wear pants again? That's never gonna happen.
I think we're gonna give up on pants generally. I think as a society, we're gonna decide that pajama bottoms are fine. Yeah, that's why I wondered a lot about what this world is, you know, and whether it is supposed to be some sort of dystopian future, because it could just as easily be a horrible present day story of somebody whose freedom has been absolutely like curtailed for some reason. But there was this kind of overtone that they're imprisoned by some sort of authority. There's the people at the end of the story who come and take the baby away. So I did get this feeling that this is the world now for whatever reason. But I thought that was an interesting aspect.
But I didn't get enough information to understand whether it was definitely a dystopia or whether it was something in the present, you know, like you said.
I was asking myself this question, like, how much information do we need? How much world building do we need to understand what's going on? And I was thinking about how even the grimmest stories sometimes give you a little glimmer of light, even if they snatch it away from you moments later. There's something in the story that you kind of know what you should be hoping for. Mm-hmm. And here I was wondering if maybe we don't quite have enough information to mm-hmm. know if there's something we could be hoping for or not. So mm-hmm. from that aspect, a little bit more world building could help us have that glimmer of light, even if the author wants to take it away from us at the end.
Yeah.
I mean, I like the comparison that you were making, or the fact that we were already talking about the lottery, because I think that's a story where Shirley Jackson, being a master, is sketching out the sort of rules and regulations of the society, as well as showing us that it's a dystopia, as well as showing us why people would make the devil's bargain of being part of this mm-hmm. of this dystopia, and doing it in what's like an incredibly bare bones way, right? The world building isn't that detailed. It's simply that we know everything there is to know about this one day per year, and we know that everyone's sort of like happy in an antiseptic 1950s way, and mm-hmm. that's it. And I think with this story, like if Martha Keddie added a little more about I really think this could be done with like a few deft lines.
Yeah, I agree. I agree that it just needs a little bit more. I mean, we can talk about what we liked first, what specific points we think are working in the story.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things that I had written down, and one of them is I love the way that we have the two rooms mirrored in the story, and one is the room that they're imprisoned in, but then the other is this pink wall of the womb and this kind of space that he builds up there. And I think that I would love for that to come through a little bit stronger even. I thought that was such a clever beginning. That we're actually introduced to the wall of the womb before we get the room that they're in.
Mm-hmm.
And I really liked that a lot. And the other thing that I really like, you know me, Sharon, but I love the ambivalence of this pregnancy at the beginning, the way that they conjure this kind of like body horror of being pregnant with this alien or this piglet, or, you know, we get all of these really gruesome elements of this state of being, and I really enjoyed that as well.
What about you, Rebecca?
Here's one thing that I really like, which is coming at, it's going to sound a little perverse, but I think that this, I read this ultimately as a very hopeful story, frankly. Like, it's a story about unbelievable sacrifice, but it's a story also about parental love, and the fact that is deep to the point of blocking off possible futures, right? There's one central conflict in the story, which is if the pregnancy is taken to term, that means that escape from this horrible situation is impossible. And the fact that the pregnancy comes to term and the mother gives birth to the baby, that means that spells like a final entrapment for the characters. But there is this sort of overwhelming sense of love also occurring, and it's a love that grows over the course of the story, right? There's an early line where the narrator, who is taking on sort of a role of a co-parent, so starts early on in the story and says, okay baby, like, okay fetus, I give you respect, like begrudging respect that you're surviving. And then by the end of the story, there's a lot, and I think this is my favorite line, and like sort of summarizes my favorite thing about the story, is talking about, we will leave anything behind, anything but you. That's the end of the story. That is the point at which the story ends on. And what that leaves me feeling is the environment of the story bleak? Fuck yeah, it's really bleak. It's terrible. They're in a filthy prison. But is the sort of humanity, is the hope for humanity there at the end of the story? I think absolutely. I think that the humanity of the two people in the cell has been infused with more love. We don't know about the fate of the babies, not looking great, but love has changed these characters. And whether or not that's a death sentence, I think that's upheld as something really lovely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I see what you mean, but I also wonder if that arc is clear enough, because I guess this is what for me was lacking at some point. I did get the sense that this is what was going on, that this person was starting to, you know, like feel love. But I also didn't see too much of a difference towards the end, except for the sentence that you just said. And I would have liked to have seen just a transformation of the fetus to a life that is going to be left behind and represent these people. I don't know.
Yeah, I think in that penultimate paragraph, we go back to some of the lines from the first paragraph. And we get again that this is an evil child. The escape plan has been ruined. I wonder if that's why that arc is less clear, because we come back to some of those really more strongly negative statements in that paragraph. Because just the moment before, we've got this miraculously peaceful moment. We've got them sleeping side by side. And I wonder if it would serve the story better to not revisit the negative emotions and just go from that peaceful moment into the moment where the baby's sort of forcibly taken away from them.
Yeah, I was puzzled a bit at the reiteration of evil and the fact that there is that the child is called evil a couple of times, because I don't know what flavor of evil that is, what that evil means to the person saying it. And I think my reading of it was, this was just spat out in high emotion, right? This is the fact that the escape plan is being foiled by the existence of the baby is just being seen as like so bad, it's evil. The kind of like blind rage you have towards a loved one where you like say horrible shit. Mm-hmm. Like that was also part of the thing that I liked about the balance of the anger and the repulsion here, is it really seemed like the kind of anger and repulsion that like comes to the forefront in arguments or feelings that you'll have, like, that are just this, like, this sort of animalistic rage that only come paradoxically from the proximity of love.
But this is where I wanted more information, just because of the, what was it? The superhero thing. They say, like, I'm no superhero, after implying that a superhero would have killed the baby. Did you get that impression as well from that paragraph?
And that line stood out to me anyway, because I found it an odd line, you know, what is it? Being a superhero is a choice or something like that.
Yeah.
Which I was wondering who was saying this.
Yeah, but it's a very...
Who has this choice?
It comes kind of packed with meaning, but meaning that it didn't really come across.
I mean, and that's where, again, where I think that the world could be explained in really... You know, not like an opening paragraph or several paragraphs saying, you know, in the land of X, there is a prison complex deep underground, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But something like saying, like one line explaining why the presence of the baby makes an escape attempt impossible, right? Like, she couldn't fit through the bars because... you know, of her pregnant belly, like, you know, anything like that. Yeah. And I think that Martha Keddie could pepper this with, like, it's a really short story, so not too many, but like, honestly, three or four sentences that explain the situation. Like, we don't even know who they are, and just say, like, the guards come with the thin watery soup every day at noon, or, you know, whatever you have. But yeah, I think we're all hungry for more.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's just like very specific details that don't have to color the world completely, but just give you an idea of what is going on.
Yeah. Another thing that another thing that I wanted to be ambiguous rather than vague was the relationship of the two characters, mm-hmm. right? I didn't yes. know if this is a woman who has been imprisoned and was already pregnant and her cellmate is trying to take care of her, or if this was a pair of prisoners together that got pregnant during their prison stay, or what, like, mm-hmm. I found myself like sort of pausing and reading back for a piece of information. Mm-hmm. And that, like, that was a little bit of a thorn in my side.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I kept trying to figure out exactly what that was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's a couple of things that sent me off on what I hope is a wild goose chase. But at one moment, there's a moment where the narrator says, it's my fault.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, is it your fault because you got her pregnant? And then there's another moment where the narrator says, remembering suddenly our mother's hands. And then I was like, whoa, hang on, our mother? Are they siblings? Like, what is going on here? So there's definitely some ambiguity there. And yeah. I don't know if that's intended or not. But this use of our really threw me, because I was yeah. also looking for these clues. And there's also something about I'm looking at your mother and her, what is it?
Her face looks like mine, right?
That was it. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. This heaving body that looks so much like my own and doesn't. And I was thinking, oh, maybe they are siblings, but then maybe not. I'm not sure.
But I mean, again, that's a layer of dystopia that would be interested. I'd be interested in knowing if this is like siblings impregnating one another in the subterranean prison where there's no food. That's a scenario I would want to know that exists.
Mm. And if that's what's intended, it should definitely be clearer, because yes. that's a whole other dark world to go into. Yeah. And I mean, I feel like it's still very, I like your distinction, Rebecca, between is it vague or is it ambiguous? Because mm-hmm. the lines in the end are, without me, you wouldn't be here. Which doesn't, I mean, they just helped the birth of this child into the world. So it could just be referring to that.
Yeah, yeah.
I realize this is truer than intended. Then we've got, without me, you would not exist. So that still Ooh. Could be referring to the birth, but exist is a different word. And then it is my fault we are down here. It is my mistake that got us here. Mm-hmm. So that's about where they, you know, like it could refer to the fact that they're in the prison. It could refer to the child. I'm not sure how much the pregnancy is what's landed them in this particular room. Like these are all these little things that I feel like we're meant to understand, that the author felt like they were giving us clues to, but they don't quite click into place for me yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think this is also very common, you know, people, when you write a story, you're like, oh, I don't want to give this away. I don't want to give this away. But you have to remember that we don't live in the writer's head. So it's always going to be a tad mysterious. So she could be a little bit clearer.
One other thing that I want to hear what you both thought of this was, I was unclear on the amount of time that passes mm-hmm. when I started reading this, because it's talking about, first there's no noticeable pregnancy, and then the line is the visibly growing bulge under your mother's loose jumper, mm-hmm. and then suddenly there's a birth happening, and even before that it seems to go from sort of, I don't know, midterm pregnancy to like the ninth month, where you can see like the outline of the kicking foot, to bam, she's in labor, bam, there's the baby's head, oh, the baby's out. Once the baby was born, I thought, oh, actually, was I supposed to read this all as sort of a narration that was happening during the time of labor? Yeah. But again, that was something that I was stuck on.
Yeah. I had the same note actually. For me, it was just simple, I would have appreciated more markers to mark the passage of time. And it's the way that she starts paragraphs as well. I think in some paragraphs, if they started more assertively, an example of that would be like, write it as diary entry dates, although that would be a little bit too cliche, but you could use a framing tool like that, or start the paragraph with a sentence that just kind of marks something as the beginning of a new day. We tried to get rid of you more than once. That would make a difference. Then now the vomiting has stopped. The vomiting stopped. There is the visibly glowing bulge under your mother's loose jumper. For me, just changing that structure on the sentence would make it easier, would make it more obvious that some time has passed. I don't know.
No. I think that you're right, Sharon. I mean, a pregnancy has very natural time markers anyway. And I think that some of those are what Martha's tried to build in. So, you know, often people are sicker in their first trimester. So when the vomiting is stopped, I think that that's a signal that we're passing into a new trimester, but it's maybe just a little bit too subtle. Mm-hmm. But I think it is a structure thing. I wouldn't start going day 72. You mm-hmm. know, I think that would be too heavy-handed.
Mm-hmm.
But just a little bit more. I can see she's grown bigger. Yeah, I like that kind of suggestion. You know, just some things that show us that something has changed. It's not the same moment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's also another time possibility is if all of this is memory that's happening during the labor, right? And then again, exactly, basically Sharon's astute suggestion with time markers that are in the past. So when the vomiting had stopped, I could see that there was a bulge under her loose sweater. Mm-hmm. Later, I also saw that X had happened. So if everything is then shifted into the past, and then there's the immediate present, which is like the baby crowning or whatever the central action is.
I think that would be very effective as well. Also, because my next question is the ending. What did you think about the ending? I opened my eyes. I didn't know what to make of it. And I feel like that was meant to have a bigger impact on me than it did. It just left me like, wait, what were you sleeping? Were you dreaming?
I mean, we have them lying in the darkness together, right? And there's this moment. So the baby's already gone. They're lying next to each other in the darkness. So I kind of assumed that they had opened their eyes from that moment. Although I don't know if you necessarily close your eyes because it's dark. But for me, it was because I think ending on anything but you might have felt slightly cheesy. And so they tacked on this, I open my eyes. But it doesn't quite give us the feeling that they're looking for. I think it's a nice idea to finish on this really short sentence, but I'm not sure what it needs to be. I don't know if the opening of the eyes has enough meaning in it. It might be stronger if he reaches for her hand or something like that. I don't know.
I guess I was reading this as a kind of new awakening for this character that has a transformative experience of love. And I'm guessing, again, this needs to be cleared up, but like the experience of new parenthood. My feeling was this was an image chosen to stand in for this, you know, this experience of, you know, quite literally seeing the world anew. But the reason I think this doesn't work is that the whole story is a process of opening one's eyes. It is the transformational past process of seeing the world in a different way. So I didn't get the sense either literally or figuratively, that this character's eyes had been closed up mm-hmm. until the point of saying, I opened my eyes.
Yeah.
And there are so many other sort of markers that you could use for something being changed. There is a new state of being that the character has entered. I don't know what that would be in like a filthy cell with a placenta in one corner. And I don't want it to be the dawn. It shouldn't be the dawn. Let's not have it be the new day is dawning, but something like that, right? Like,
yeah.
I think that opening eyes doesn't work exactly. I think you're totally right, Sharon.
I mean, the real physical change that's happened is there was a baby and now there's not a baby. And there was a womb that was full and now it's an empty womb. I don't know if there's something like there that could be played with. I reach out and caress her empty womb or something, you know, that could leave us with the poignancy of what's happened and the transformation that's taken place. I don't know. But I agree with you. I didn't get this picture of them lying there peacefully with their eyes closed. In my mind, it was they're lying together in the darkness with their eyes open, very blank, you know?
Yeah.
There's one image that jumped out to me, which was this kind of absurd one. And I wanted to know what you thought about it. And I'm just trying to find it. But they're imagining the baby in a blue swimsuit with diver's goggles on and a little hat. And it was a really absurd moment. And I kind of liked how absurd it was.
Yeah.
But tonally, it felt so different to the rest of the story. Yeah. What did you guys think of that image?
Can I read it out loud?
Yeah,
please.
I have begun to imagine you as a swimmer with a tiny turquoise swimsuit and a ridiculous little hat. And sometimes you even wear diving goggles. How much joy you must feel to float weightlessly in your bubble.
That's where when I started doubting the fact that it was just a normal dystopia.
Yeah, because this is super details rich, right? We get the first color. I mean, I think maybe gray walls are mentioned somewhere else, but this is the first little spark of color. We get an adjective there that's really lighthearted, this ridiculous little hat.
Mm.
We get something as physical and real world and current world as diving goggles. And I was like, oh, what is this? It really took me out a little bit because it's so whimsical and almost affectionate. And I really felt like it was from a different story in some ways.
Yeah.
That was one of the reasons why my reading of this was so inflected with this sort of like affection was this is a really sweet sentiment.
Yeah.
You don't fantasize that on someone that you just purely hate
mm-hmm.
or that you feel just sort of abject disgust and ill will towards. Like mm-hmm. I don't think you fantasize someone else's joy.
Mm-hmm. No, but also because it's kind of isolated.
Yeah. So I think that if that's something that they want to work into the story, then there need to be more moments like this.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's where the blue curtains come from at the end, you know, like maybe we get turquoise again as a word or something like that. But I definitely could see how it could work, but at the moment it's just a little bit incongruous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Yeah.
Any last tips?
Oh, I think it just like as a like final thought, like one of the questions you gave me to think about was, does mm-hmm. the story grab you from the beginning? And what I would say mm-hmm. to Martha Keddy is, you do not have to worry about the story sort of leaving me feeling like, oh, not sure if I want to bother with this one. I mean, this is definitely a strong opening. I don't know anyone who isn't sort of intrigued by Evil Baby. But even if there is someone who's not like Evil Baby, I'm fucking in. The way this first paragraph like synthesizes dread and this filthy claustrophobic atmosphere, I think this story starts amazingly strong.
Yeah. I agree. I feel like that was my note on what I like most about this story is there's like, I really admire this hook because this is what we want when I read a short story and also when I write. And she's got it.
Thank you for listening. Our music and artwork are by the talented Judy Moore.
If you want to submit a story, send it to storiestrumpets@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and read our submission guidelines on storiestrumpets.wordpress.com.
If you like what you're hearing, don't forget to rate us on Apple, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And seamless. I feel like I'm like a malfunctioning wind-up toy over here, just being like, ah!